smestions.
Looking forward to the live version.
It's going to be great, isn't it?
It's very good.
Yeah.
I'm going to go full Fiddler on the Roof.
Excellent.
I think it's one of my favourite musicals. Actually, there's a thing about musicals coming up in this very, very section.
Very good.
Mike says, current colonial commoner here, living on the sunny Gold Coast in Australia. However, I was brought up and lived on the British Overseas Territory of Gibraltar until the age of 18, at which point I moved to Newcastle to pursue a degree and subsequent career in architecture. I can confirm that Gibraltar does in fact have cinemas. So we had this whole thing about British Overseas Territories and which of them had cinemas.
Yes.
It might be that Mike provokes some strong reactions here.
Go ahead. Provoke away.
Gibraltar does have cinemas. When I was younger, I remember there only being one, the Queen's Cinema, a rather large Art Deco-style building, named, as many things are in overseas territories, after the presiding head of state. In fact, it was located off Queensway Road, named after the route that QE2 took during a visit to the peninsula, and not too far away from King's Wharf. A new cinema complex was built in the early 2000s, comprising four screens, in the King's Bastion, a converted wartime bunker used as a fortress during the Great Siege of 1779, where the British Army fought back the invading Spaniards. Curses! It's quite an interesting building and a good example of a heritage conversion, and it includes the aforementioned cinemas, as well as a bowling alley and an ice rink. You might think at this point we're going to get to the question.
Yes.
As a side note, I once did a design for the refurbishment of the Gibraltar Cruise Terminal and can verify that the building can, in fact, dock the Kermit and Mayo take that cruise liner when you do round off your trip of the British Overseas Territory.
Very good. I'm looking forward to it.
Hello to Jeremy Irons. I appreciate the email.
I've forgotten the Jeremy Irons thing.
Thanks very much. I just noticed that there isn't a question. But anyway, it's thank you very much,
you,
Hannah, for bringing
Mark coffee
at that point. I could see he wanted to say thank you.
I did
you.
Say, I whispered it.
He whispered it, yeah. But he was just very studio aware, which makes a change. Anyway, so it smells.
Treat me like I'm a child.
Smells good, that coffee. It smells strong. Mike,
it's damn
you
fine coffee.
Very much. Have you been to any cinemas in the British Overseas Territories? Do let us know.
So there wasn't a question?
No. Nope.
It was just some schmestion.
You know that whole title of this feature. The general idea is you ask us a question, not just write in with stuff advertising things that you've been involved with.
That used to happen in hard left meetings in Manchester in the 1980s.
Well, that sounds thrilling.
You get a whole bunch of people in a room and then somebody would start talking and they'd be going, you know, well, the inevitable decline of capitalism is blah blah, and somebody would go, point of order. You were allowed to interrupt with a point of order, but not with a question. Point of order would inevitably be somebody would just get up and talk for 5 minutes. And then you go, and the point is, and then they'd ask a question. And you go, no, you're not allowed to ask a question.
Right, classic.
It's a point of order.
There was a wonderful, this is a hard left point.
Go on.
Where on Times Radio, Matt Chorley was interviewing Noam Chomsky. And it's a hilarious sequence where Noam Chomsky's talks about Jeremy Corbyn winning the 2017 general election. And there's like a beat's pause before Matt Chorley goes, well, no, he didn't. And I'm sure, no, he did. He won the 2017 election.
What?
No, he didn't. That was the... Anyway, but Noam Chomsky didn't like to be challenged on this part. And I think what he was...
Did he mean the leadership? He won the leadership of the Labour Party?
Jeremy Corbyn won the general election until the British establishment sat on him and he didn't win.
Anyway, did he literally just not accept
it? He didn't like being challenged by...
It's not challenged, it's true.
I know.
It's like, even Tucker Carlson... Oh, incidentally, we haven't said this, but this is the first show that we have recorded since Tucker Carlson was shown the door at Fox and the world was told 9 minutes after Tucker Carlson, who was in the process of renegotiating his contract until 2029, brilliantly signed off on Friday... Talking about pizza, see you Monday. No, you won't, schmuck.
So we're actually on and broadcasting in this podcasty way, and he isn't.
He isn't.
What a joyful moment.
Yes.
That is.
Where will he go to?
Some kind of cesspit, I suspect.
No, I think he was in Fox News already.
Well, a
smaller cesspit.
Yeah, with more cess.
Yeah. How's the Harry stuff going?
Very good question. Alastair says, I'm sending this email as we near what I've recently discovered is Alien Day. Despite being a huge fan of the first two films in particular, I hadn't realised this was a thing. I'm of an age where I was too young to see these films at the cinema at their time of release. So imagine my delight when I found out that as part of Alien Day, I'll be able to go and see Alien movies on the big screen and get the full cinema experience of one of my all-time favourite films. Fingers crossed for Alien to be showing next Alien Day.
Which date is Alien Day?
Don't know. Whenever I start thinking about the Alien films, I always start to wonder what it must have been like to see these films without any prior knowledge mm-hmm. of what was going to happen, particularly that iconic scene in Alien. I know it's unlikely to be a spoiler after 44 years, but considering the topic of this email, I still don't want to mention it specifically, just in case. He's talking about the
chestburster
with John Hurt, all that kind of stuff. I think after 44 years, come on.
Yes.
So this brings me to my question. If you could watch a film for the first time again, what would it be? This could be because, like me, you knew more about it than you wanted to before you saw it, or maybe because the film made such an impression on you that you'd just like to experience that again. So let's say that any movie that you've already mentioned in this series of podcasts, you're not allowed to
mention. You're not allowed to. Well, can I firstly just say on the subject of the Alien and the chestburster, I didn't know. I saw Alien.
I didn't either.
No. I saw Alien at the Gaumont in North Finchley, and all I knew was that it was a science fiction film that was frightening because the posters had invoked The Exorcist, and they'd said something like, you know, Exorcist in space or something. But I knew nothing about what was going to happen. And when the chestburster happened, and people can laugh about this now, I genuinely thought I was going to wet myself. I was shocked in a way that I haven't been since the opening of Jaws, the death of Chrissy, which is so horrifying. And then when we were making the Alien documentary, the Alien Evolution documentary, which is on the Blu-ray and the HD version, we interviewed all the cast members because there was this story that the cast members didn't know what was going to happen either. Well, obviously the cast members had read the script. And so, but there was a certain element of surprise. What they did was they filmed the scene in the morning of them sitting around the lunch table and, you know, John Hurt starts eating. And then John Hurt, in that brilliant John Hurt way, goes, you know, and he starts writhing. And if you remember, that scene ends up with Yaphakotu wrestling him onto the table. And he's literally, so they cut for lunch as he's wrestled down onto the table. They then go off to lunch, but it's a long lunch because they have to do all the reset. And Sigourney Weaver told this brilliant story. And I said, you know, is it true that you didn't know what was coming? She went, well, the first thing is we went off in the morning. We came back 3 hours later. And she said, the first thing you noticed was that all the crew were wearing Pacamacs. So we knew something was up. And she said, and John was on the table, but obviously there was prosthetics, because obviously what it is, it's his head and then it's the prosthetic around the thing. The thing that is true is that what they didn't know as the thing plays out is that the T-shirt is ripped and the blood comes out. And they didn't know that what they were doing underneath the thing, because they knew that there was a, you know, they knew something was coming out and they knew the puppet. And there's a famous story about when Giga first showed the chestburster to Ridley Scott, he came in with it like under his cape, you know, and he was going to give.
He wore a cape.
He wore a cape. Wow. Giga was unbelievable. Anyway, he brought this thing in and he went, ta-da! And Ridley Scott said it literally looked like he'd stuck his hand up the back of a chicken. And that was what the original chestburster looked like. Anyway, there's pipes blowing blood as the sort of wormy thing comes out of the chest. And the blood went way further than anybody had expected. So it wasn't that they didn't know it was going to happen, but the surprise was that blood hits Veronica Cartwright full in the face. And the reaction that everyone talks about Veronica Cartwright going, ah! You know, that's real. And it's real because she didn't expect the squirt of blood to hit her. But in the cinema, it was astonishingly scary.
And there was less media, no internet, so you know these things, these secrets are kept for a lot longer.
Yeah.
So to answer Alastair's point, a movie to see again without knowing anything about it, is there something that springs to mind?
Without knowing anything at all.
Like Sixth Sense. I mean, the movies that work best here are the movies with twists. Arrival, I think I would put in that category of...
Although you said that seeing Arrival the second time is more fulfilling because you know.
Yes, I think so. But I would like to see it again.
For the first time.
Slash third. Also, maybe kind of murder mysteries, I mean, like LA Confidential, it would be nice to go and see that again for the first time because I thought that was fantastic.
I mean, I'll be honest with you. There are very few films in which the main appeal of them is that something happened that you absolutely didn't expect. That said, the great privilege of being a film critic is that you quite often see films without any prior knowledge. You don't even know what genre it is. So I knew nothing, for example, about Polite Society. And when in the third act, it turns into, you know...
Driller killer.
It's not Driller killer, but it's this kind of weird science fiction Cronenbergian... What? Sorry, is this real? Is what? You know, now I presume that... There's a certain amount of knowledge about the film. I haven't even seen the trailer, so I don't know how much of that is in the trailer. But I didn't know anything about it at all. But I am quite used to the experience of seeing things without knowing anything about them. The thing I think that I would like to see for the first time again is probably Woody Allen's Sleeper, because I laughed so much during the slapstick sequence in that when they wake him up. And he's only half conscious, and he's doing the thing about putting the food in the guy's face. And the first time I ever saw it, because I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know who he was as a filmmaker. I was just told it was a science fiction film. I went with my friend Mark first, and I laughed so hard. And I'd love to have that experience again. Slapstick comedy seeing for the first time is brilliant.
Similar topic from Dan. Dear Absolutely Fabulous production team and the other two, I absolutely adore Spinal Tap, 1984.
Yeah.
It is, in my correct opinion, the funniest film ever made. My dad, who introduced me to the film, agrees that it is very funny, but often says it doesn't actually make him laugh. This leads me to my schmestion for both Mark and Simon. Is it possible to find a film funny even if it doesn't make you laugh? And if so, what examples can you think of? Bonus question, what is the funniest film you have ever seen?
That thing, I mean, my feeling is that a funny film has to make you laugh. You can find things wry and satirical and...
you can laugh quietly inside, maybe.
Chuckle. But I think a funny film should make you laugh. I mean, I've seen Spinal Tap a million times and every single time I laugh. Every single time I laugh. I know the jokes. I know the rhythm of the jokes. I know the script. It doesn't mean I don't laugh. I mean, I think the funniest films I've ever seen are probably slapstick comedies, which I just, you know, I've got an endless fascination with watching, you know, Buster Keaton or Harold Lloyd, and we talked to Peter Bogdanovich about that documentary and about that. I do find physical comedy endlessly rewatchable. Funniest film ever made.
Well,
I mean, Life of Brian is always the thing that comes top of the list.
And everything, but comedy is so personal as well, is that some, you know, there might be a genuinely laugh out loud movies, which other people leave you completely cold.
I mean, I would say Splash is probably the film that I have laughed at the most. I love Splash.
I think Holy Grail is funnier than Life of Brian. Life of Brian is a high concept.
Yes.
But I think.
And is a superior film, but Holy Grail is probably funnier.
Holy Grail
funnier.
Is funnier. I think Young Frankenstein, is consistently and laugh out loud.
No, actually, I take back Splash. Young Frankenstein is a brilliant choice. You and I once did a tour when we were showing clips from movies and we showed My Lottery! And every single time.
And it is fantastic.
Werewolf.
Also,
Werewolf. Why are we talking like this? You started it.
Parenthood is very funny. So I would pitch that one in, but maybe...
But Parenthood is also very poignant.
Like Porridge.
Yes.
You did a porridge joke the other day.
I did do a porridge joke the other day, which is that thing about, you know, what is it about this prison? Very high criminal elements.
That's the one. anyway, Dan, we've answered half your question, but anyway, that's probably good enough. Rachel says, as well-turned-out chaps, and particularly Mark, with his vintage styling, I was wondering what your thoughts...
Does it say with his vintage styling?
Yes. I was wondering what your thoughts are on dressing for the cinema. There's been correspondence in the past regarding cinema goers taking off items of clothing to get comfortable. This is clearly wrong. What I'm asking here is whether you ensure that you are looking well-groomed before heading off to the cinema. I like to be reasonably dressed, but my husband will comment, why are you bothering when we're going somewhere to sit in the dark? Down with the Nazis, up with the blue-haired feminists, or red and purple in my case. And hello to Jason. I think you should just always look, dress comfortably.
Yes. I think in the cinema, dressing for comfort is the key thing, because it's, you don't want anything that's going to I mean, when I was a younger man, I used to go to the late night screenings of Rocky Horror at Baker Street. And of course, everybody dressed up that. And it was, I would always dress as Brad, because, you know, you couldn't tell I was dressed up. It just looked like me anyway. And I went to a shock treatment screen. Actually, we did a shock treatment screening in the...
Give me shock treatment.
Yeah. Have you seen the film of Shock Treatment?
No.
Yeah, no, nobody did. Anyway, it's quite interesting. But we did a screening in which people came dressed as characters from Shock Treatment, and I like all that stuff. And there was a sort of thing about when you went to the Scala or to the Phoenix for the late night, you know, there was a sort of slightly grungy, gothy aesthetic. Anne Bilson sent me a fabulous photograph of her outside, I think it's the Electric. And she's got this kind of, she looks really vampy and really kind of, looks like, you know, exactly the kind of person who should just be about to sit down for an all-night marathon of illegal movies that you shouldn't be able to show, you know. But no, I don't dress up for the cinema.
Jack from Hinckley in Leicestershire. As well as being a lover of film, I am a book nerd. Find that I concentrate best when reading with instrumental music in the background. I used to listen to music generally, but found anything with vocals
words in it, yeah,
distracting. I have a couple of instrumental albums that I love, particularly a group called Square Peg Round Hole, but I became conscious of overplaying them to the point of exhaustion. Therefore, I started listening to film scores, which has worked a treat. However,
you know, there's a program that's ideal for you.
Much like vocals, I found some more dramatic scores like Interstellar or All Quiet on the Western Front, while amazing pieces of work were equally distracting at certain points. I found the score to a recent film, Broker, by, is it Jung Jae-il?
Yes, Jung Jae-il.
Jung Jae-il, to be perfect for what I'm after, with its piano and acoustic guitar and generally chilled out vibe. Can Mark recommend any scores similar to Broker that,
yes,
I could add? I mean, if only you were presenting a radio show on Scala on a Saturday afternoon that was full of this kind of stuff to add to my repertoire. Before Mark goes, I mean, I'm going to chip in Mark Knopfler's soundtracks. If in doubt, look out for Soundtracking, which is like a best of his soundtrack music.
Oh, also, is that okay?
Max Richter and Sigur Rós, I would just, yeah, chip in.
So but, Max Richter, you and I were having a conversation about last night, and I said, oh, put on the Mary Queen of Scots soundtrack, because there was a particular piece that had...
reminded you of something else.
It had echoes of Zadok the Priest. Max Richter's sleep cycle is absolutely wonderful. There is a film of the concerts that they did, the late night concerts that they did, in which people listened in on beds and sleeping bags and fell asleep during it. And so it, technically, you know, you can pretend that it's a film soundtrack. And I've played loads of tracks from that on Scala Radio, my show every Saturday.
Is that right?
Yes, it is. 1 till 3.
1 till 3.
Absolutely. The two things I would recommend.
The show that comes after it.
Yes, that's Simon Mayer's Essential Albums.
It's quite strong.
Yeah, it's quite strong. But obviously, it's like the uplift, isn't it? It's like, you know, it's the uplift from the show before. It's
that's
the
right.
Inherited so, audience.
That's true. I'm not sure we inherit. No, actually, but it is fantastic, because you listen to that and there are no other programs that do what your program does.
So. Nor indeed what your program does. So the two things I am going to recommend for you.
Yes.
Firstly is the score album for Drive My Car by Eiko Ishibashi. I think it's pronounced Ishibashi like that, but it's Eiko, E-I-K-O, Ishibashi, I-S-H-I-B-A-S-H-I. It was my favorite soundtrack of last year, and the album is absolutely perfect to listen to and to work to. I would also suggest that you listen to there's stuff by Asuka Matsumiya, who did most recently a kind of science fiction inflected soundtrack. But if you listen to any of her stuff, going right back to the short films that she did, you can find her on Spotify, and her music, her film music, is brilliantly ambient. Obviously, there are the scores of Philip Glass. You know,
not going to do the joke.
But it was a good joke. And they are all, I mean, I find that, because the reason we got into this was because you started playing me, you had a minimalist playlist.
Yes, so
that you,
I mean, you mentioned
to.
Spotify. So Apple have just launched a classical app,
right.
Which is fantastic and does what it says on the tin, but it's just very intuitively organized. And they have a minimalist playlist. And some of the aforementioned, there's lots of Max Richter, there's lots of Philip Glass. Also, fantastically, and this is, I was going to mention to Jack, things like Spiegel im Spiegel by Arvo Pärt and things like that are just, they're just on. And
yes.
It's just filling the room with wonder whilst you carry on doing your reading.
Yes, and while you carry on being able to concentrate fully on what you're doing. And I completely agree about the vocals thing. The other thing I would say that I have listened to whilst writing is Philip Glass's Akhenaten. The problem with Akhenaten is that there are speaking sections in it, you know, open, other, double gate, all that stuff. You have to kind of skip over that. But generally, Philip Glass, you know, obviously, Koinis Katsi is this sort of thing that anybody could listen to at any point. But there are really, really, if you, the minimalist stuff, but specifically instrumental soundtracks, like I said, Eiko Ishibashi, Asuka Matsumiya, who's fantastic. Richie Sakamoto, there is a brilliant collection of Richie Sakamoto's work that was done on, I think it was the re-recordings. There is a really, really great album of Brian Eno's soundtracks that is called something thrilling like Brian Eno, film soundtracks, 1971.
Yes, so that sounds
like, literally,
Brian,
it sounds completely fun. And that's terrific. And as far as the Mark Knopfler stuff is concerned, the Local Hero soundtrack
is fantastic.
Is a joy.
Although then you get the Jerry Rafferty song, which is kind of like, it has.
I know.
Which is a lovely track, but it doesn't fit. Anyway. Musicals. John Ashton in Nottingham. You mentioned during Series 1, Episode 48, whilst talking about John Wick, that some people will like this sort of film and others won't get it, and used musicals as an example of a genre of film with similar issues.
Yes.
I do not like musicals.
Okay.
And always sneered at them, not through snobbery, just because I too never got why people should just burst into song. It's weird. However, I have two exceptions to this rule. Fiddler on the Roof, which we mentioned earlier, and Rocky Horror Picture Show. Why? Because in both films, every song is amazing. Not a beat missed, not a feeling unfelt. But I struggle with all others, and I know many others do too. So my question, could you recommend any musicals for people who don't typically like musicals? Are there musicals that could convert those like me who automatically dismiss films of this genre?
Yeah, well,
with people being nice to each other.
I chuck in two examples. The obvious one to cite is Cabaret, because Cabaret is the one that people like Nigel Floyd, who's one of my best friends, but Nigel will always say, I don't like musicals, but I like Cabaret. One of the reasons is that people don't just burst into songs. The songs take place on stage in the cabaret, and the drama takes place outside, but it is a musical with musical interludes. Incidentally, during the time that I was away, I went to see Cabaret on stage in London, and it was brilliant. It was with...
Your man.
No.
Your woman?
Yes.
Excellent. I'm glad she was in it.
She was great.
So that's Cabaret. What was the other one?
The other one is All That Jazz, which again is Bob Fosse. And All That Jazz, I think, is a musical for people who don't like musicals, because the musical numbers are fantasy sequences. He is staging musical numbers, but he also has a heart attack and stuff happens to it. So it's a kind of, you know, self-revelation thing. And again, you don't have the musical problem of why are they singing? And I think it's interesting that both of those have that, you know, they get round the why are they singing issue. Rocky Horror, I love Rocky Horror. It's kind of all over the place. I mean, even the plot of Rocky Horror makes no sense when they get to the floor show. It's like, sorry, hang on, why is that, why does the seducer, how? But, you know, and then, of course, brilliantly, Shock Treatment, which makes no, even Richard O'Brien, who made Shock Treatment, says, yeah, it's an absolute complete car crash of a film.
I would chip in Oliver, which I think is magnificent. And
yes.
Never at one moment do we think, oh, not another song. because they are magnificent. I love Evita. That is my personal
favourite. Yeah, that's great.
Favorite.
And the film of Evita is brilliant, yeah, the Alan Parker film.
And the music is great, but Tim Rice's lyrics are just, really, really clever, very, very smart. And to state the obvious, Poppins and Sound of Music,
yeah,
which I think would stand out. And at no stage would you go, oh, another song.
Can I tell you because Amy Lee Wood is in Cabaret, and it is brilliant. And obviously, she came on our Halloween show. But did I tell you that the way that I found out that she was doing Cabaret? Did I tell you this? When she was on the Halloween show, okay, because she was on to talk about Living, because yes, it's her and Bill Nighy. And I said, so what are you doing now? She said, I can't tell you, it's top secret. I went, okay. She went, I'm doing Cabaret.
relentless questioning.
I'm doing, don't tell anyone.
two final questions. David says, whilst listening to a recent interview with Simon Le Bon, I was reminded of the musician Ed Fliss, who records under the name Duran Duran Duran. I think this is a particularly funny name. Are there any names of artists, musicians or bands that you find particularly funny? I saw a solo artist who called himself Griff Pilchard, which I just seemed to think was vaguely amusing.
Why Griff?
As in Cliff Richard.
Griff Pilchard. I see.
When I was doing evenings on Radio 1, we had a session from Camper Van Beethoven.
Which is a very good name.
Which I thought was funny. Crispy Ambulance were also...
It was a brilliant name.
Did a session. And I came across the other week, and I'm going to get this wrong, but the band are called Dananananan Aykroyd, which must be the most mispronounced name. So it's Dananan and then another Anan and then Aykroyd.
Aykroyd.
So that's pretty funny.
I always thought Half Man, Half Biscuit was a brilliant name.
Very good.
Somebody once tried to explain to me that it meant something, but I actually didn't care. I think Get Cape, Where Cape Fly is a brilliant name.
Yes.
No.
I suddenly thought of Fetus on My Breath, which was just not very nice.
Yes.
That's another John Peel.
Yeah.
But in terms of genuinely laugh out loud, I think Dananananan Aykroyd is laugh out loud.
It's very good. But it comes down to, it was all the tribute bands, wasn't it? There was a bunch of, none of which I can remember now, there was a bunch of very, very sort of funny, tribute band names, not the Strolling Bones and the Bootleg Beatles and all that stuff, but I'm just looking at this. There's the Ian Duncan Smiths, which I think is funny.
What a thought. Where are you going for the night? We're going to go and see the
Ian Duncan Smiths.
Lord help us. The final question, which comes from the good Viking Jens in New Zealand. Winner of a £10 WH Smith gift voucher in the News Shopper Colouring In competition in 1981.
Okay.
Over the years, you have accompanied me whilst doing the lawn on Saturday mornings, jogging on many long-haul flights for work. It would only be fair to let you know that you have shared my ear holes with four, now two, other English chaps who got a rare mention on your show recently. They are the leather trouser donning and electronica pioneering Depeche Mode, who at age 60-ish, like your good selves, are still belting out the good stuff and the new stuff. I regard them in similar highness to you, since like you, they have accompanied me through life and whatever it throws at me. I am indeed what you would call a devotee and sit in a more shaded corner of the good church near the electronic pipe organ. I wanted to know your thoughts on Depeche Mode. I value your opinion, whether you like them or not. They've always been incredibly prolific and often derided by their peers in the UK music press, particularly in their early years. Love the show, adore the top-notch and visually stunning production team, up with Bluehead Feminists and down with fascists like Birdsong, who Dave Garn a few years ago referred to as Birdsong. So I would say, and then he says, Tusen Tak, the good Viking, Jens in New Zealand.
Well, can I go first?
Yes, go on.
I love the early Depeche Mode stuff. I love the poppy stuff. I absolutely, I think, is it called Speak and Spell, the mm-hmm. album, and See You and, Just Can't Get Enough. All I think those are, because I'm an absolute sucker for a good synth pop hit. And I remember when, they're from Basildon, aren't they?
They are from Basildon.
And I remember the NME doing a piece on them, and it had a photograph of them, and Dave Garn had his hand in front of one of his eyes in a kind of what looked like a real rock star mode, but it turned out it was because he had a sty.
Fair enough, yes, absolutely.
And I thought, I love that. That is so un-rock star-y that you're in the front room in Basel and you get a hand over your eye because you've got a sty. So it's the early poppy stuff that I thought was great.
As far as I'm concerned, I think they're absolutely brilliant. And I like their early pop stuff. Saw them live at Nottingham Concert Hall in the kind of, it was after Vince Clark had left, yeah. but they were still doing a lot of that pop stuff. I've always thought they've been underappreciated, particularly in this country. Around the world, they are a stadium.
They're
act.
Huge, aren't they?
They are doing one show, because I interviewed Dave Garner, Martin Gore. They're just two of them now. Andy Fletcher died quite recently. In fact, as they were starting to make the new album. And the only gig they've announced in the UK is Twickenham, right? Which I have vowed to never go to see a concert ever again in Twickenham.
Is that Twickenham Rugby?
Yes, absolutely. It's just inaccessible. Just awful place. Okay. Anyway, so, but as a side issue.
Hello to all our listeners in Twickenham. Yes, in Twickenham. Certainly.
Who would probably not want another rock show there ever again. But I think they're brilliant. The new album is Memento Mori. 54 UK hit singles.
50, wow!
54 singles, 17 albums.
Are they critically incredible. Savage? I'm not aware of this.
I think the critics ignore them now, I think, but around the world, they are just a huge act, and I think they're okay. brilliant. And when they turned up at the end of episode one of The Last of Us, yeah. Never Let Me Down Again, I just thought, okay, fine, I'm absolutely in there. And it sounded absolutely magnificent. So the answer, Jens, in New Zealand.
Yeah, we're on, yeah. We're
absolutely
we're,
on your
we are team Depeche. What does it mean,
Depeche Mode? I think it's just COD French, really.
Does Depeche mean COD?
No, I just think it sounds...
No, I know what you mean, but, you know...
Pret-a-manger.
That's right. They were going to call themselves Pret-a-manger. Then they considered calling themselves Starbucks, but they went for Depeche Mode instead.
Your questions will be very welcome for next week. Send them to correspondence@kermanomeo.com.